Lawmakers consider how to vet grant opportunities in South Dakota education. From South Dakota Public Broadcasting, it's Thursday, July 22nd. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, SDPB's Lee Strubinger looks at the latest in a debate over how history is taught across the nation, with a focus on schools here at home. Then we talk science-based parenting. Author and science reporter Melinda Wenner-Moyer joins us for a look at how to raise kids who aren't bullies or liars or racists. Drought conditions are worsening in South Dakota. Eric Helland is with us for a conversation about tending your garden and landscaping. Plus, we check in with the high school rodeo finals in Lincoln, Nebraska. That's coming later in the hour. We're broadcasting live today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first.
With South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Jenna Scott. The State Department of Human Services plans to change the way it cares for individuals with developmental disabilities. That's led one lawmaker to call for the closing of the state's original care facility. SDPB's Lee Strubinger has more.
The South Dakota Developmental Center currently treats about 70 people with developmental disabilities. It was built more than 100 years ago in the small town of Redfield. The center once treated more than 450 people at a time. The Department of Human Services plans to shift to smaller care facilities across the state. Those could be open for residents within the next few years. However, one lawmaker says the state should also consider the cost of such care. Sioux Falls Republican Steve Haugard says having one facility makes it difficult for families who don't live near Redfield.
We just need to be honest with Redfield and tell them that we're closing this thing down within a certain number of years. Right now we're spending $300,000 per person per year to house these individuals. If we drop that population down, what we expect to, down to 60-some this year, it'll be $400,000 per person to keep them there. And those services can be provided elsewhere.
Haugard says those services could be spread across the state. There are also 74 open beds at the Human Services Center in Yankton. Others disagree. State Senator Brock Greenfield is upset that Representative Haugard ambushed developmental center officials with calls to shut them down.
Those people work their tails off. They are overworked. They're underappreciated. They're underpaid. And I want them to know how much I appreciate them, how much the northeast part of the state and the broader state of South Dakota appreciate them.
Greenfield says it's short-sighted to say the state can diminish costs by relocating the facility or its residents. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Lee Strubinger in Rapid City.
Drought conditions in South Dakota are getting worse. The situation is taking hold in the fields and prompting new restrictions in and around the National Grasslands Park near the Black Hills. SDPB's Laura Johnson reports.
Fire restrictions now cover part of the South Dakota grasslands and sections of Custer, Fall River, Pennington, and Jackson counties in the west. Ryan Cumbo is acting zone fire management officer. He says firearms are still permitted. Precautions have helped the park keep fires to a minimum in the area.
We haven't really had anything on the forests or on the grasslands recently, but there has been some in the past. Luckily, they've been very small. The fire departments have been getting on them real quick.
Stage 1 fire restrictions mean park visitors cannot build fires outside of designated metal fire pits or set off any kind of explosive devices. Also prohibited, fireworks, smoking, and chainsaw operation without a spark arrestor. June was the driest month on record in South Dakota. The National Center for Environmental Information reports that the drought conditions are evident in the fields. Brad Rippey is a USDA meteorologist. He says crops such as corn and soybeans are taking a hit.
You know, we do have serious problems in parts of the Dakotas, much of the Dakotas, and parts of Minnesota at this point. So it's a little early to know. I mean, we just have this crop heading into reproduction now. But we know the forecast is not all that particularly favorable for the same areas that are hurting.
Drought conditions also affect crops like wheat and barley. With South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Laura Johnson.
And for more stories, you can always visit our website. That is sdpb.org/news.
I'm Lori Walsh. As you heard, drought conditions are worsening in South Dakota. We're going to get an update here with National Weather Service hydrologist Mike Gillespie. Mike, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Lori. Thanks for having me.
Where do you want to begin? Thursday is when the new drought monitor is released, and it seems like the conditions are still worsening. What can you tell us?
Yeah, there isn't a whole lot of change across South Dakota on the U.S. drought monitor this week. Little bit of, you know, some minor changes here and there. I guess the biggest change would be kind of down along the Missouri River, Lake Francis, Case area, Gregory, Charles Mix County. The D3 that was down there a week ago has been upgraded to D2 based on a little bit of precipitation that fell that way, as well as some people getting out and taking a look at the fields and seeing that things weren't quite as bad down there as areas a little bit farther to the north. But we do still have a large portion of north central South Dakota, as well as areas along the Missouri River from, say, Pierre down to Chamberlain, and then eastward across the, you know, kind of the southeast part of the state, Sioux Falls, up towards Madison. You know, those areas are still being classified as D3, as well as a small area kind of out in the Kadoka area.
Yeah. How about some of those rivers and streams and lakes? What are we seeing as far as river flow, and how does a drought impact them?
Yeah, the river flows are quite a bit below normal for most of the rivers and streams, particularly in eastern South Dakota, where we don't generally see flows getting down. You know, a lot of the rivers are running less than 100 cubic feet per second, you know, which is quite a bit low for the bigger rivers, the James, Vermilion, Big Sioux rivers. You know, they're still not in that drastic range, but they're getting closer. For example, the flow at the Big Sioux near Del Rapids is closing in on 50 cubic feet per second, and I know that that's when the city of Sioux Falls starts enacting some additional water restrictions, is when that Big Sioux flow starts dropping below that 50 CFS.
Yeah. What are some of the impacts when we think about the drought on agriculture and, you know, haying and ditch haying and pheasant habitat for the bodies of water themselves? You know, what are some of the impacts of this kind of drought?
Yeah, the main thing is going to be any communities or rural water that relies on some of the rivers and streams, you know, for water supply. The groundwater levels, kind of focusing a little bit on the Sioux Falls area because that's where I, you know, have the main focus, and we do have some real-time groundwater wells from the USGS just north of town here, and those are still running at what would be called record lows, at least over the last 15 to 20 years that we've had that data for this time of year. So the groundwater is getting used up. Soil moisture is way behind normal for most areas. So, you know, water supply is going to start having issues if we continue to see these dry conditions going forward.
Yeah, how much rain makes a difference then? If you wake up and the sidewalk's wet, don't celebrate just yet. what do we need?
Yeah,
what do we need?
It's going to take quite a bit of rain to get us out of drought completely. But any rain we can get right now is beneficial. You know, if you get even if you get a quarter of an inch, like some of the areas we saw last night and early this morning, picked up around a tenth to a quarter of an inch. That's going to help out some, but you know, this time of year, especially with temperatures getting back into the 90s, you know, grass is going to be using up you know, a half an inch per day on evaporation and transpiration. Corn crops, soybean crops, obviously, are going to be even more than that. So, you know, we need to start getting to where we're seeing an inch or two of rain a week just to kind of keep things where they're at right now.
Are you optimistic about that happening?
I wish I could be, but as of right now, looking out for the next 10 days or 10 to 14 days, it looks like we're going to continue to be above normal on temperatures and most likely below normal on precipitation for most areas. You know, we're in that time of year where we're going to have some spotty thunderstorms popping up. Generally, you know, the late afternoon, evening hours, kind of like what we've seen here and there the last few days. But overall, it does not look like we're going to be getting out of this warm, dry pattern for at least the next couple weeks.
Mm. And so for those people who live in the Sioux Falls metropolitan area, those water restrictions are looking more and more likely.
It's very possible. We'll just have to see how the river responds and how much, you know, water is coming out of the system. And, you know, I know the city is monitoring that every day and keeping track of where the rivers are at and where those groundwater wells are at and how their water supply is working. So, you know, it's obviously their call as to when they, right, you know, go to the next level of water restrictions if they do. As of right now, I think we're getting pretty close.
Mike Gillespie is a hydrologist for the National Weather Service. Later in the hour, we're going to talk with Eric Helland about living in that area and taking care of lawns and plantings that you've already done and the trees and such. So we'll continue to follow the story and the drought impacts across the state. Mike Gillespie, thank you so much for being here with us. We appreciate your time.
Thank you very much, Lori.
Ahead on the program, SDPB's Lee Strubinger reports about lawmakers' efforts to monitor more closely what's being taught for South Dakota history. You're on listener-supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
In his definitive book, The Big Bands, George T. Simon profiles 75 named band leaders from the 1930s and 40s. The last of them, Elliot Lawrence, has died at the age of 96. He's best known among jazz fans for recording some of Jerry Mulligan's earliest compositions. I'm Carl Gerke, and this evening on Jazz Nightly, we'll hear music from the Elliot Lawrence Orchestra. You can join me at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on SDPB Radio.
Program funding by a co-op agreement with the U.S. Small Business Administration. If COVID-19 impacted your business, SDCEO Women's Business Center offers complimentary confidential advice. More at bhsu.edu/SDCEO.
SDPB's Fiddles and Friends returns this August with 3 live concerts. Enjoy music from talented fiddlers including Kenny Putnam, Tom Schaefer, and Owen DeYoung. Join us in Watertown on August 26th. Sioux Falls on August 27th or on August 28th in Rapid City. Help support SDPB and get your tickets today by going to sdpb.org/fiddles. Sponsored by Chris Bro Hospitality and First Bank and Trust.
Program funding with your support and by Ingalls Homestead, Laura's Living Prairie. Sharing Laura Ingalls Wilder's pioneer heritage through covered wagon rides and hands-on activities. Online at IngallsHomestead.com.
You're listening to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Some South Dakota legislators are engaged in efforts to review and restrict some of the classroom curriculum taught at state universities and K-12 schools. Others say educators should set the standards and goals for the classroom, not politicians. SDPB's Lee Strubinger reports.
Some Republican leaders want to get involved with what students learn in civics and history classes. They want to delay any applications for federal grants that deal with those academic areas. The same goes for developing civics and history curriculum in K-12 schools. That gives lawmakers a chance to review and potentially restrict classroom content during next year's legislative session. Republican Spencer Gosch is the Speaker of the House. He wants the legislature to have a good grasp of what's being taught in schools.
My concerns are that we've got a federal mandated program that's being rushed in when the legislature's away. My concerns are that we get an opportunity to properly vet what's being pushed down into our schools.
When asked about the mandated programs that are being pushed into schools, Gosch said grant opportunities come with strings. He wants lawmakers to review them. Legislative leaders are picking up on national efforts to politicize the teaching of history and the role race has had in shaping U.S. policy and politics. State lawmakers have outlined their concerns in a letter put before the Joint Committee on Appropriations. The letter will be used as a basis for the fiscal oversight of state agencies and their continued funding.
I think it's our job as elected officials, people that are elected by the taxpayers, to do their due diligence in evaluating what's going on with the taxpayers' money and how it's being spent.
The letter points to a proposed rule for grant opportunities from the Federal Department of Education. The department recommends, among other things, that classroom teachings should reflect the nation's racial, ethnic, cultural, and linguistic diversity. The Biden administration says those concepts are reflected in the Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and the 1619 Project. That project, created by the New York Times, centers around the consequences of slavery in U.S. history. Governor Kristi Noem says the project misleads students into believing the country is evil.
We do not have hatred and racism in our DNA. We reject that full-heartedly. It is a lie.
Noem says she wants to preserve honest and patriotic education that fosters a love of the country and a realistic picture of its virtues and challenges. Others say educational standards should be set by educational professionals, not politicians.
You know, America has done great, great things, but a history that is not known is bound to repeat itself.
That's Democratic State Senator Troy Hinert. He's Shichangu Lakota and sits on the State Senate Education Committee. He's sponsored bills in the legislature that establish schools steeped in Ocheti Chicoan culture. Hinert says it's important to teach about policies that have and continue to keep Native American children from reaching their full potential. Hinert says it's hard for society to move forward if history isn't taught accurately.
And it doesn't have to be adversarial, but you cannot do this if you don't know the accurate truth.
Hinert says the recent discovery of children's bodies at the Indian boarding schools is a prime example.
And you need to look no further than what just happened in Rosebud by bringing those, you know, the children home from Carlisle, Pennsylvania. We don't have to go clear to Pennsylvania to find Native kids that never made it home. We can do that right in South Dakota.
The South Dakota Teachers Union says classroom curriculum should be determined by education professionals. Sandra Waltman is with the South Dakota Education Association. She says teachers want an honest education where all of history is taught, the good and the bad, and have thoughtful conversations about them.
If we look to how South Dakota does it, our legislators will see that we don't have an issue here because our standards are determined by professional educators. There's public input, and you know, our local school boards are working with their educators to come up with the curriculum that's appropriate for our students.
A group of about 50 people are participating in a review of South Dakota's social studies standards. They spent 8 days in June examining standards for K through 12 curriculum and will release their report on August 6th. Statewide public comment will begin on September 20th in Aberdeen. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Lee Strubinger in Rapid City.
You can find and share this story from our website, sdpb.org/news. Ahead on the program, science-based strategies for better parenting to help you raise kids who aren't jerks. Author Melinda Wenner Moyer is up next. You're on listener-supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
People are rushing to get jobs in this economy, right? Kind of depends.
The jobs that come available early in a recovery tend to come first double at the low end, and that's not the right job for everybody.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, post-pandemic life versus pre-pandemic careers, next time on Marketplace.
Tonight at 6:30 Central, 5:30 Mountain on SDPB Radio.
Program funding is provided by Sanford Underground Research Facility, supporting South Dakota teachers and students with classroom resources, field trips, and professional development. Learn more at sanfordlab.org.
If you are responsible for your organization's marketing strategy, I'd like your attention for a moment. When you underwrite with SDPB, you are not purchasing airtime or a sponsorship. Your investment makes it possible for us to continue telling stories that are important to South Dakotans. SDPB listeners are more likely to be in upper management, have a valid passport, and save for their retirement. These are the people you reach when you underwrite with SDPB. Email us, underwrite@sdpb.org.
Program funding with your support and by McCrory Gardens in Brookings, planting over 40,000 flowers every spring. More information at McCrorygardens.com. McCrory Gardens, ready to bloom.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. While most parents strive to raise healthy, happy kids, they also don't want their children to be bullies or liars or racists. Author Melinda Wenner Moyer is an award-winning contributing editor at Scientific American, a regular contributor to the New York Times, and a former Slate parenting columnist. Her latest book is a meticulously researched and delightfully accessible look into science-based strategies for better parenting. We can't actually tell you the full title on the radio because the FCC would not approve, but we can tell you it is a hands-on guide about how to raise kids who aren't, you know, jerks. Hey, Melinda, how's it going?
Hi, I'm good. How are you?
I am well, and I've had more people tell me not to say the A word on the radio today that is in the title of your book that I feel we should start with a chapter on swearing because I feel like a toddler again with people reminding me not to use a bad word. So, so this covers all kinds of science-based parenting skills, but let's start with the swearing and lying chapter. Kids sometimes test things out, don't they?
Absolutely. Yes, I have two kids, and they think the title of my book is hilarious, by the way. Yes. So the nice thing, I guess, to hear is that every kid learns swear words. There's really, I mean, in a way, there's nothing you can do about it. It's not your fault if your kids learn swear words. And same with lying. It's actually kind of a normal part of development. Every kid is going to lie, and also it's like kind of a sign that your kid's brain is working because lying is complicated, right? You have to like think ahead. So they're not all bad, I guess, is my point.
Yeah, yeah. My dad used to always say the truth is easier to remember than a lie, which I think was, again, working with that child development. Like, you know, kids try something out and then they forget what they tried. And so he would just calmly remind us that the truth is always easier to remember. What are some of the ways that parents can deal with, according to your research, modifying behavior that they are a little nervous that their kids might stick with?
Yes. Well, so I guess we could stick with the lying and swearing example. Yeah. What researchers say is that when kids lie or swear, the best thing you can do is to stay calm. And there's a few reasons for that. If your kid swears at you in anger and you then explode in anger, it kind of tells them, wow, this really makes mom mad, and I'm going to keep this in my back pocket for next time I really want to get a rise out of her. And so in a way, it gives them power, and that's not really what you want to convey. And with lying, too, it seems the research suggests that the more we can kind of respond to lying with calmness and kind of trying to understand why our kid lied and what was going on, the better able they are to listen to us and understand, you know, why what they did was not okay, and the more likely they then are to sort of learn from that conversation. So this is a theme really with a lot of the things I came across when researching this book, is that staying calm and having these conversations are actually much more productive than like exploding in anger and yelling at our kids.
Yeah, or laughing, which is, a lot of, you mentioned that in talking about sex as well, is that sometimes you just laugh because it diffuses the tension or you don't know what to do. But honestly, these are serious questions that kids have and that you need to sort of address. More broadly, this idea of messing it up, because I feel like every parent is going to mess up something. You know, their kid is going to say something or do something that they just don't know how to respond to. How do you circle back and say, I want a do-over as a parent?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I think it's really helpful when parents make mistakes. We all respond in not so constructive ways when our kids do things, and we all make parenting mistakes. And I think to the degree that we can then recognize, oh, I could have handled that better, and tell that to our kids and approach them later and say, you know, gosh, I didn't handle that situation really well, and explain why. Like, I was really upset and I wasn't thinking straight, but I'd like to apologize, or let's have that conversation again. That's really constructive because it shows your kids that everybody makes mistakes. It, like, normalizes making mistakes, which I think is important for kids because otherwise sometimes they think when they make mistakes, you know, it means that they're terrible people or something. We want to say, no, mistakes are normal. They're okay. They're part of being a human. And then, you know, we're also kind of showing modeling to our kids what we hope they will do when they make a mistake, that they'll fess up, that they'll apologize, and they'll try again. And that's through, you know, how we are dealing with our own mistake. We're communicating a lot to our kids.
Yeah. Let's talk about some of the surprises that you found. Some things I just, as I was reading through the book, I was like, yes, I knew it. I'm a parent of an only child, and so I try not to comment much on sibling rivalry because I've never raised siblings, but I am one. There were four of us. And tell us a little bit about letting siblings kind of fight it out or share, or what are some of the things you learned about helping siblings get along that maybe surprised you from the research?
Yes, this was definitely an area where I learned a lot. So psychologists used to recommend to parents that they basically stay out of sibling conflict. They let, you know, let the kids work it out by themselves. In doing so, they will learn how to resolve conflicts themselves, and that's great. But then when researchers actually observed what happened when siblings were left to deal with conflicts, of course, what happens is the more dominant child wins, and often through coercion or through physical force. And so then what's actually being taught to them is that, you know, bullying and coercion are good ways of resolving conflicts. So these are not teaching them good skills. And another thing that parents sometimes do, which, again, is also not super constructive, is, like, refereeing a fight that kids have. So jumping in and sort of saying, okay, here's, you know, this kid's right and this kid's wrong, and here's how we're going to resolve it, and sort of jumping in and solving the problem for them. And that's also not great because, A, they're not learning anything from that. And sometimes you can get it wrong, right? You're not really aware of the context of what's going on, and you end up, you know, on the wrong side of the fight. And so what researchers have found works best is to really try to mediate conflict, like to help kids resolve their conflicts themselves. And that means when your kids are fighting, you go in and you acknowledge that they're fighting, acknowledge there are big feelings, like, oh, everybody seems really angry right now. And then if they're fighting over something, take, like, the teddy bear away and let everybody calm down for a minute or two. And then have each child tell their side of the story, what happened according to how they saw it and how they experienced it. And that's really, really productive because then the children learn the other child's perspective. And they, you know, and it helps them realize, oh, you know, my brother really experienced this differently. And that really helps to build a skill known as theory of mind, which is like the ability to take perspectives. And then you try to help them brainstorm an equitable solution. Like, what is a good compromise we could come to? And in doing so, you know, you're really helping them develop these better conflict resolution skills and thinking through, you know, what would be a way to resolve this that both kids could sort of feel comfortable with and happy with.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a lot. I mean, it can take time to do this.
It can take time, but I find being prepared, you know, having a few of those things in your back pocket and you're ready, you know, you have a plan, which is helps you not become so emotional as a parent. And the book, I should mention, you know, at the end of each chapter has key points. So if you need to go back and just mark those pages, you can reference them quickly or, you know, I don't know, bookmark them on your, you know, electronic reader or whatever people who read that way do. I don't know. I've got post-it notes here in the book. But really fascinating stuff about sexism and racism. And I want to start with this idea of gender and just how often kids are getting the message that gender is such an important part just because of how we naturally speak. Go ask the lady, you know, your teacher, you know, had a nice skirt. Look at your pretty hair. If there's all the time we're giving kids gender messages from a very, very young age, many of which we don't even realize that we're doing. Tell us a little bit about how kids internalize that gender separation must be really important at such an early age.
So kids are like little detectives. They are constantly looking out in the world and listening to what other people are saying to try to understand what social categories matter. You know, what should they be paying attention to? And with gender, we are constantly hitting them over the head with the fact that gender matters. Because, as you said, you know, we refer to it whenever we refer to people. If we use pronouns, we are indicating gender. We, of course, have different bathrooms for different genders. We have different toy store aisles. We have very different clothes and toys that we buy for boys versus girls. So there's all these ways that we are sending to kids this message that, wow, gender matters. Boys and girls must be very different, or else why would parents be referring to the different genders, and why would society be set up this way if they weren't really different? And the problem is that when kids, so they think, okay, there must be differences, and then they also look at the way gender plays out in society, and they see the hierarchy that exists in terms of, gosh, there's never been a woman president, and, you know, gosh, most people in, who have a lot of power in this country in general are men, and this is changing, certainly, but this hierarchy still exists. It's not equal. Kids notice this, and they also, they combine this with the messages we send about gender, and they start to make these assumptions like, well, gosh, gender matters. Boys and girls are very different. Boys have more power and status. Maybe that's because boys are smarter or better. And that is the conclusion that kids will come to, and it's obviously not a good conclusion. And we see it in the research that kids around the age of 5, or actually 6 and 7, girls will start to assume that boys are smarter than girls as a general rule. At age 5, girls think girls are the best, but then it starts to shift over age 6 or 7, and it's heartbreaking, and I've seen it with my own daughter. She said to me the other day, I wish I could be a boy so that I could be president. And I had to, that was a conversation we had.
And then that's the question of planning your comments that are developmentally appropriate. So how do you tell your daughter in that case, well, girls can be president, but also, by the way, I have no examples of that. And, you know, how old do they have to be before you, how much do you tell them? At what time?
Yeah, well, I started early. I think in a way, it's never too early to be having conversations, as long as they, you know, you make them somewhat age appropriate. But, you know, you can be pointing out a lot of the kind of sexist tropes you see in, even in like TV shows and movies. One thing I talked about with my daughter a lot is the fact that people comment on her appearance a lot, and they do that a lot more with her than they do with her brother. And, you know, why is that? And I've talked about how our culture really expects girls to look a certain way, and that our society kind of tells girls that appearance matters more than anything else. And I say, you know, I don't agree with that, and I don't think it's right. But having these conversations, then she starts to notice things too. We were reading some fairy tales the other day, and she pointed out that one of the men was being sexist because he was bossing his wife around, and it was great. So we can talk about the ways that, you know, the things that we see in our culture that are sexist with our kids. We can also just not emphasize gender as much as we maybe otherwise normally would. Like, you know, don't buy your girls all girly toys and clothes necessarily, and same with your boys, and try to sort of de-emphasize gender in that way. It can be really helpful.
Yeah, and racism, our kids, some of the stories in this book where parents say what they heard their kids say or do, you just cringe, or the moments where they do something wonderful and you just, you know, weep with joy because we put this kind of pressure on ourselves. You know, the classic example, I was talking to a teacher the other week and said, yes, in her classroom, there's a kid with light skin who says he doesn't want to sit next to the kid with dark skin because he will get what he said was dirty. How do you deal with something like that when you have, you know, what does the research show us about dealing with racism and how to correct students in a helpful way?
Kids certainly do say racist things, and that's just... That's true. So don't necessarily, if that happens with your kids, take it as evidence that, you know, your kid is a terrible child. This is common, unfortunately. But how do we respond to it? So what researchers have told me is that, you know, it's very upsetting when you hear your child say something like this. But we need to keep in mind they don't always understand the gravity of what they've said. They don't necessarily realize what it means. So we should respond, again, calmly and say maybe something like, oh, that's an interesting thing you just said. Where did you hear that? Or what does that mean to you? And try to get some understanding from them of what they mean, what they think they mean, and then again calmly, instead of shaming them, because when we shame or get mad at kids, it's harder for them to listen to us. We should explain why it's hurtful and give the context to say, you know what, that word is very hurtful, and if people hear you say it, it's going to make them feel really bad.
It's not true. Yeah, it's not true.
It's
yeah.
not true. Yes. Yes. That is, of course, very important, too.
Yeah.
But we should be responding, but, you know, in a calm, not sort of angry and shameful way.
The great thing about this, the takeaway that I really enjoyed about this book, though, is that there is hope. Like, we're watching these kids grow up and really be world changers. They know more than we knew. We have access to more information, science-based information, than our parents ever did. I found the book to be really optimistic. Did you find that as you were working? I mean, there's some frustrating stuff in here, like, wow, we're still having this conversation. But other times it was like, wow, we really can do better.
Yes. I completely agree. And that was one of the really amazing things, looking at the research. I was looking into research on all sorts of different traits and how they're shaped in kids. And what was amazing was there really was clear evidence that how children are parented, you know, the types of conversations parents have, the types of, you know, the ways they respond to their children, they really do make a difference.
Yeah.
Certainly, you know, kids have different temperaments and personalities, and there are things, you know, in the nature-nurture debate, certainly nature plays a role, but parents really can make a difference depending on how they interact with their kids. They really can shape their kids into the people they want them to be, and that was really optimistic.
Melinda Wenner-Moyer's book, featuring science-based strategies for better parenting from tots to teens, is available in hardcover now. We've got more information on our website at sdpb.org/news. Thanks, Melinda. Great book.
Thank you, Lori.
Let's take a moment now and head to DeSmet, South Dakota. DeSmet is known worldwide as the little town on the prairie. This year marks the 50th anniversary of the Laura Ingalls Wilder pageant. The weekend forecast for the event looks promising, if a bit warm, with abundant sunshine and highs in the high 80s to low 90s. Winds should be light at 10 to 11 miles per hour. This weekend, visitors can meet actors who played Almanzo and Nellie on the Little House on the Prairie television program. An outdoor worship service is open to all on Sunday at 10 a.m. on the pageant grounds. Visitors can also find activities and wagon rides before pageant performances each night. Grounds open at 6. The show begins at 8. Audience members watch the sunset during the outdoor theater performance and look out at cottonwood trees planted by Charles Ingalls. Ahead on the program, drought conditions in South Dakota are worsening. Eric Helland is with us for a look at gardening and growing. You're in the moment on listener-supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
I'm Robin Young. Cities are using unarmed counselors to take calls police once did. In Eugene, Oregon, they've been doing this for over 30 years. One trained responder is well aware he's cutting down on suicide by cop.
I love being able to tell people when I show up that they don't get to kill themselves because I'm not a cop.
Next time, here and now.
This afternoon, beginning at 1 Central, Noon Mountain, on SDPB Radio.
Program funding is provided by First Dakota National Bank. First Dakota National Bank celebrates individuals and businesses with a passion to turn their dreams into South Dakota firsts. Learn more at firstdakota.com/first.
Some people get to be Cinderella or the prince or fairy godmother or even the evil stepsisters. And I anxiously await to see what I'm going to be. And I'm given the role of fairy dust.
Join us for more true stories told live. This time, quilting, bartending, CPR, and fairy dust. That's on the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
Listen Saturday afternoon at 1 Central, Noon Mountain on SDPB.
Program funding by the South Dakota Humanities Council, presenting this year's One Book South Dakota, The Children's Blizzard by Melanie Benjamin. Learn more about her virtual author tour and in-person Festival of Books appearance at sdhumanities.org.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. Drought conditions are worsening in South Dakota. For this week's South Dakota Home and Garden, Eric Helland is with us to look at how to tend to your growing during this difficult season. Hey, Eric, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Lori. How are you?
I'm fine. It's dry.
It is very dry.
It is dangerously dry. And we talk a lot about, cattle ranchers and farmers and ag industry, tourism and visitor season. But for this segment, we're really going to just talk about what's in your own backyard.
Right.
Lawns and grass and plants and the things that you invested in.
Right.
For landscape. Let's talk about grass and lawns first.
Okay, so grass and lawns, I would not be so concerned about saving those or keeping those alive because they'll just actually just kind of go dormant. But the thing to remember on that is you kind of have to use a little bit of restraint and don't mow. Mm-hmm. Or some people might say, you know what, I'm happy not to mow.
Well, that's me, you know.
And me too, because I'm like going, well, let's just not mow for another week or 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Because it's not going to do any harm. It actually helps the plant out because it'll shade itself.
Mm-hmm.
And whenever you cut anything, you trim any shrub, bush, plant, even pieces of grass, they always want more nutrients and water. And that forces growth, and growth then requires more nutrients and water. So as far as plants and perennials and shrubs and things like that, a lot of the perennials that have been there for over a couple of years probably have established themselves well enough to be able to survive some drought. If you are open to watering and you want to, then water, like we've been talking about, is just water thoroughly. That means putting water on it to where it just slowly seeps in and it gradually gets to the root zone. Trees are really important because trees are always taking water up.
Mm-hmm.
We might notice if we continue with this drought that trees will just start to shed their leaves, and that's just a natural occurrence of what trees will do. What to do in the meantime, look some positive stuff. Well, take care of the house plants,
mm-hmm.
you know,
because sure.
you're staying inside. When it's hot and dry like this, do not water because the water is just don't water with a sprinkler because you throw the water up into the air, it's gone, it's evaporated. Just let it sit on. You want something that you can dump and basically pour around the ground, around the perimeter of the plant. And
so
if
you're
do,
watering a tree, like put the hose there and just let it soak in for how long?
Oh, geez, depending on the size of the tree. But you could anything's going to help. 20 minutes, the longer the better, of course. Right. But you can, if you do it for like on a really, really big tree, and I'm saying like a diameter of a 12-inch tree, you're going to want to put that out in the perimeter, like where the drip line is. That's where how far out the branches go. Okay.
Oh, okay.
In that drip line, that zone.
Mm-hmm.
And put the water there.
Not at the base of the trunk, yeah.
Not at the base of the trunk because it'll help, but you're better off because all of the feeder roots on most plants are all on the periphery.
Okay.
Maybe 1 or 2 feet out of a perennial. Shrubs are, basically however wide the shrub is, that's where the roots are.
All right.
So that's kind of a good rule of thumb.
Planting to prepare for drought or mm-hmm. prepare for flooding or prepare for inconsistency. Are there certain choices that you should be making? I'm guessing the tropical plants are not native to this area.
Yeah.
Is that a problem? Is that not a problem?
So that's not a good one. Yeah, tropical plants, well, those require a lot of water and then they also mm-hmm. require fertilizer. But what you really want to look at is the plants that are original to this area. Okay, like an oak, a bur oak tree, or an ammer maple, things that are have been grown and originally were here before we were even here. Well, I'm sure there's been a drought around here a few hundred years ago when we weren't around,
right?
And those plants survived. And so, those are the ones that you'd want to stick to. Grasses are really good ones because some grasses will have their roots go down for feet. To
sure.
find water, and they know how to, they'll turn it on, meaning they can sustain these drought conditions. And then when they get enough moisture, then they'll start to grow again. Just things, nature knows what it's doing.
Mm-hmm.
And if we can help it along a little bit, and then some places it's just like, look at the grass between the sidewalk and the street. It's browning.
Mm-hmm.
Don't try to save it. Let it go.
Yeah. Are you finding people who come in and want less grass, less lawn, and more of a natural-looking landscape, more landscaping, more hardscaping. Is a lawn the thing to have anymore? Like we sort of imagine, you know, suburbia, 1950, this beautiful green carpet. What are we trending toward?
Yeah, planting beds are better. And we are seeing more planting beds, more larger flowering beds, and less grass. Because grass is maintenance. Every week you have to do something with it, you know, typically if you're watering and mowing, right? Hardscaping is really popular as far as the patios in the backyard or even some patios in the front yard. I mean, there's just a lot of different things, but that's what people are, you're finding that a lot of the people are looking for. Yes, less maintenance. But then we kind of spell it out to them, okay, less maintenance doesn't mean more grass. Less maintenance probably means maybe a little bit larger flower beds with maybe not as many plants in them, but kind of that happy balance.
Yeah. We don't have water restrictions from the city of Sioux Falls. I'm not sure of other areas that have watering restrictions. Do you need to do anything different during the watering restriction time if it comes, other than just like obey the rules? But so just be more on top of it? Are there certain things that you like, well, now I just need to let this go?
So the water restrictions that I think would be coming down is you're not going to be able to water your lawn. Or you'll be able to water. I think right now we're always on odd even days. And then you cannot water anything between 12 and 5. Now, if they go, the next step may be they go to watering once a week. But also remember is the city of Sioux Falls is selling water. So the revenue is necessary also. So they're playing that balancing act. And then just trying to pick off the areas that you want to keep alive. When you have trees and stuff like that and you have containers, put them underneath an area that's going to be shaded for a lot longer than it normally is because that'll take less water. Use your water that you're, you know, rather than filling up a whole another glass of another bottle of water, you're dumping that out to get it fresh. You know, go take the water out and put it on one of the plants. And so that's one of the things that some of the things that you can be looking at is just trying to how do you minimize or maximize whatever water you're using. Take shorter showers.
Sure. Yeah, which is kind of what we should be thinking about all the time. Anyway, this is not an unending resource, water, thinking about and where it comes from and how you're using it and how you can capture it when it does rain.
Next week is the beginning of August, isn't it?
It is. Next week is the beginning of August.
Let's hope we get something.
Do you do rain capture barrels or things like that at landscape garden centers? Do you have people interested in that?
We have it there just for looks, really. We don't really pull any water out of it. We've got wells, and then we collect a lot of our water at our new site. We're collecting our water into a big pond, and then we also are doing watering by using drip irrigation. So all of all of the plants are being watered specifically. It's not just thrown into the air. So that's another way to do it. It's kind of, but you're right now. It's like, okay, how do I just maintain everything?
Affecting the industry at all?
What's that?
The drought affecting the industry at all?
I haven't heard too much around here yet, but it will very soon. And what we need to do is like mulching around plants. That really helps because that'll keep that soil cooler. Mulch is great. Wood mulch, the grass mulch and stuff like that is that's the one you don't probably want to do.
All right. Yeah. Eric Helland is with us here every Thursday. You can always send him questions in the moment at sdpb.org. It's all part of our South Dakota Home and Garden community. Hashtag South Dakota Home Garden. And we have digital content on our website every week. And you can also tune in on the weekends to see the digital shorts on SDPB TV. Eric, thank you.
Thank you.
South Dakota rodeo athletes are competing this week in the National High School Rodeo Finals. Dale Christensen is state director for the High School Rodeo Association, and he is joining us now from Lincoln, Nebraska with an update. Hey, Dale, thanks for making time for South Dakota listeners.
Hey, thank you. How are you guys?
We are doing great and kind of following on the website how the competitions are going. Give us, folks back home, an idea of just how many South Dakota rodeo athletes are down in Lincoln and what the community is like for those athletes when they travel.
Well, I tell you what, we have, they're four in each event. South Dakota's pretty fortunate to send a full team down here. We send four in each event, and so we have one of the bigger teams down here. All the big rodeo states, they send a full team. But so there's probably about 55 or 60 kids with our queen, and everybody's down here. It's one big family. So, and Lincoln's been treating us pretty good. So it's good to be down here. It's a little hot and muggier than we're used to, but it's good.
All right. I saw some athletes were coming from Hawaii, and I just really wanted to know, did they bring their horses? Like, what? Tell us a little bit about how some of the livestock travels.
The Hawaiian team and a lot of the Mexico team members will lease horses when they get here. Actually, Maryland, it's their first year here. Those teams that travel for a long distance, they'll lease horses in the area. And it's happened that way for years. So they'll find a high school family or a goat tire or a pole bender, barrel racer that has a horse that they'll lease to them so they don't have to haul their horse if they're across the ocean. So.
All right. So, yeah, that makes sense, right?
Yeah.
All right. How is the team doing? What do you want to talk about first?
Well, I'll tell you what, the team is doing good. We're into the second. We just finished the second performance of the second go-around. So I don't have our team standings right now, but at the end of the first go-around, our boys were sitting second in the nation.
Wow.
And right behind Texas. And the girls were 18th. But our team is sitting in fourth place. Now, things change daily after every performance, but a great first round. I mean, the list is we had two kids end up second in the round. Saddle Bronc Riding, that was Talon Elsher, finished second. And Steer Wrestling, Dawson Kautzman was second in the steer wrestling. But Benton Good was 13th, and Greg Gilbert was 27th. All the steer wrestlers did fairly well. Dawson Kautzman was also 10th in the tie-down roping, but Lincoln Petersek was right behind him in 12th.
Wow.
Laney Stevens was 10th in the pole bending. Barrel racing, Landry Haugen ended up 7th in the pole bending, or in the barrel racing in the first go-around. Devin Moore, the bareback riders, come out and kind of just stuck it on all of them. Devin Moore was 4th. Cooper Filipek was 14th. Cashton Ford was, I think, 19th, and Reese Reeder was 26th. So all four of those guys covered their horses.
Yeah.
Breakaway roping, Chloe Heron was 13th, and she did miss her calf in the second go-around just a little bit ago. And Mason Moody was 16th in the bull riding, and Thane Elsher was 11th. So we've had a great first round. I mean, it's been pretty awesome, and I just got handed some results here that Landry Haugen is sitting number 9 in the all-around standings, and Laney Stevens is number 10 in all-around standings.
Oh, wow.
And as a team, we've dropped to 9th place, but, you know, that's early in the second round. So we're tickled with all these kids, the way they're participating. The boys have dropped to 7th, but like I said, some of those tougher kids, those kids are sitting real good. Haven't got to go in the second round yet, as we're only two performances in that round. So.
Yeah. All right. So how do you kind of maintain over the duration, you know, with the heat and, you know, just the amount of time? Is that causing any problems for anybody?
Probably just me. I'm getting tired. The kids, I mean, they're resilient. And, you know, the facilities down here is cautioning them, you know, just hydrate, you know, keep the horses watered, keep cool. And hasn't been terrible as far as South Dakota heat.
Right.
But the Nebraska heat's a different one. It's a humidity, and it's supposed to get pretty bad Friday and Saturday, the way it sounds. They're talking a pretty high heat index. So. Yeah. But it's just the humidity that gets us South Dakota kids.
Yeah. When you take a horse, when you take livestock down, do they perform differently? I mean, like, how do you prepare? Or do you just travel for rodeo all the time? So they're kind of used. What can you tell me about, you know your horses so well. How do they respond to the atmosphere?
You know, they respond well. You know, everything is the bucking horses will get a little – it's just like anybody else. When it's hot and miserable, they'll get a little mad. They get a little harder to work with. They may not buck as good. The cattle may not run as hard. But, you know, we try to bring in the best livestock for each event here. And the horses, these kids, and the parents keep track of all these horses. We got vets on duty on staff here, and they got wash racks and covered stalls pretty much. I tell you what, the facility got them covered again in a hurry because they blew down last week in a storm. Oh. But that's our number one priority besides our kids is our animals, and whether it's the livestock in the arena or our horses.
All right. Well, you have a favorite event that you just can't wait for? Like, what is it based on what you have performed in? Or what are you looking forward to in the days ahead, I guess?
You know, I just look forward to all these kids. And I'm the arena director in the rough stock pen, so I got all the rough stock, the goat tying, and the pole bending in my arena. And I just, the best part of this whole deal, there was a girl the other day, and I don't even remember where she was from, but she tipped all six poles. And when she got to the end, she just looked up to the crowd and pumped her fist, and the crowd went wild. You know, they have sold out grandstands here in Lincoln. You know, it's just a camaraderie. It's a kid who rides a bull for 50 points that doesn't usually get him covered. That's what is so cool. That's what I love to see. But a favorite event, it's probably saddle bronc riding because I'm from South Dakota.
There you go. I'm afraid I'm going to have to ask you to explain pole bending because I don't know what it means.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm sorry. Well, pole bending, there's six poles standing in the middle of the arena, and the gals will run down one side, turn a tight corner, and come back through them, weaving in and out every time. Get to the end again and do it twice, weave in and out of those poles and race back to the line.
Okay.
It's like a more complicated barrel race, but it's it's done in 20 seconds. So it's a very cool event if you really study it.
Okay. I'll learn that one next. I've been fascinated by cutting. So you helped me through that one time and to understand cutting and sorting. I'm like, okay, that kind of makes sense to me. Now I'll have to watch some pole bending. Dale Christensen, thank you so much. I know that you've been really running ragged, so thanks for taking time for South Dakota listeners for a little update from Lincoln, Nebraska. We really appreciate your time.
Thank you, guys.
Dale Christensen is the state director for the High School Rodeo Association. If you missed any of our spotlight coverage on rodeo last month, it is all available online. You can go to sdpb.org/spotlight and find many interviews and photos and stories from everything about the music at rodeos to some of our most iconic athletes.